you see, so far in our journey through the book of Acts, we've seen how the church began on the day of Pentecost, what that entailed. As we journeyed through the book of Acts, we've seen how the church grew among the Jews first. We've seen what has taken place, what Jesus said, what he told them, that you will be my witnesses first in Jerusalem, and then in Judea, and then in Samaria, and then to the uttermost parts of the earth. That is now beginning. And we've seen how the church grew not only among the Jews, but among Gentile proselytes and the Samaritans, and even among the pagan Gentiles. And now Paul finds himself in Athens, which was the center of educated and highly cultured intellectual Greeks. When you see that, look at that, that Athens was the home of Greek mythology. Athens was the center of the classical intellectual world as such. It was the center of the entire foundation of Western civilization in regard to agriculture, to architecture, to sculpture, to philosophy, to physics, to mechanics, astronomy, you name it. Medicine, mathematics, Athens was the center, as well as Alexandria in Egypt. But Athens was the center of those things. Athens was what they call the cradle of democracy, where the concept of democracy came from. This great city that heard Socrates. Socrates was a real person. Socrates was the greatest of the Greek orators, the greatest of the philosophies. Plato's the one that mainly talks about Socrates. We don't really have any writings of Socrates. But Athens is where they heard Plato, who was the student of Socrates, where they heard Aristotle, who was a student of Plato, and Pericles, and Democritus. Where we get the term democracy from is from that man, Democritus. But Athens lived, even during Paul's time, when we come to this, Athens lived nostalgically on their past glories. And we're going to see how this impacts with Paul and the Athenians today. The Greek scholar Horace called the city of Athens empty and dormant. What he meant by that even though Athens was the center of democracy and the center of all these things, as far as intellectually, and it was the site of intellectualness, it was still empty. And really a dormant city as such. Well, now, here along with this, as we look at Acts 17 now, beginning with verse 16 and following, Paul comes. Paul lands in Athens, in that great city of Greece. But Paul, what do we read here in Acts 17? Verse 15 following says, "Now those who escorted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they left." So the Thessalonians who brought Paul to Athens, or excuse me, the Bereans who brought Paul to Athens, they went back. And Timothy and Silas are still there, and Paul said, "Have them come to me now." So they left, but Paul was left alone in this city of Athens. And it says, verse 16. "Now while Paul was waiting for them," let's say how long, "but while Paul was waiting for Timothy and Silas, While Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols. And the city of Athens was full of idols. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews. So Athens is a huge city, and so there is a synagogue there. And Paul goes there. Remember, that's his first strategy that he uses. If there's a synagogue in that city, or there's Jews in that city, that's where he heads to first. He takes the gospel to the Jews first. So there's a synagogue in Athens. And he goes there and he's reasoning with them, with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles. That's the Gentile proselytes. And in the marketplace, what was called the Agora, every day, with those who happened to be present. So before we get to this part, you look at Paul. Paul's in Athens, this great city. Paul was from Tarsus, a Roman citizen. But Paul was an intellectual giant himself. Think of that. Paul was an intellectual giant himself. The scriptures tell us that Paul was a Hebrew of Hebrews. He was taught by Gamaliel, the greatest rabbi of his time. He was a Pharisee. Not only a Hebrew of Hebrews of the tribe of Benjamin, but he was also a Pharisee. And at the time, before he became a Christian, he was a Pharisee of Pharisees. If we look further in the book of Acts, we'll see later on in Acts chapter 22, verse 3 and 26, it tells us, he says, I'm a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you are all today. And in verse 26, it says, when the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and told him, saying, what are you about to do? For this man's a Roman. And in Philippians chapter 3, verse 5, Paul tells the Philippians there, circumcised the eighth day, of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, the Hebrew of Hebrews, and as to the law, Pharisee. So Paul was an intellectual. I want you to see that. Paul was an intellectual giant himself. Paul was from Tarsus. The people of Tarsus were avid in the pursuit of culture. The people of Tarsus applied themselves to the study of philosophy, the liberal arts, and the whole round of learning in general. The biblical scholar F.F. Bruce says, so much so that Tarsus, in this respect, at least surpassed even Athens and Alexandria, whose schools were frequented more by visitors than by their own citizens. So one might say that Tarsus of that period, in Paul's day, was like Seattle, a university city. But Paul knew who he was called by throughout his epistles, how he begins his epistles. You read Romans chapter 1, verse 1, 2 Corinthians verse 1 and verse 1, Galatians chapter 1, verse 1. Paul said, I'm an apostle of Christ Jesus, called by him to bring the gospel. So Paul was a well-knowledge man. Well-around man. And more so than that, Paul was an experienced servant of Christ. Do we realize by the time that Paul gets to Athens, by the time we have gotten here, Paul had been preaching or proclaiming the gospel a long time by now. It is now the early part of 52 AD. Paul was converted in 35 AD. That's about 16 or 17 years now, give or take, that Paul has been proclaiming the gospel. Thus, Paul was not a novice in proclaiming Christ. And here he is. He's an evangelist. He's a preacher, a proclaimer of the gospel in a pagan world. And not only that, now he's in Athens, the center of learning, what they would call it at that time. But notice Paul's preparation here. The word that is used here when it says, "Now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols." Athens had more idols than you could count. And of course, the greatest of them was Athena, or Diana. I'm going to have a picture of that. I'll show a little later next week. Or you quickly go that to that now and show that. But Paul's spirit, what that says in the Greek, his spirit was stirred. He was provoked. He saw all these things everywhere he looked. Paul saw idols and memorials to the past. Petronius, a Greek scholar, way back when, Petronius once said of Greece, in general, that it would be easier. Notice what Petronius said. It would be easier to find an idol in the city of Athens than a man there. That's something? It'd be easier to find an idol than a man there. And that was especially true in Athens. Paul experienced this. And the more he looked around him, that's what it means when he said the spirit was provoked, that he was stirred up inside. The more he looked around him and saw all those things, the more agitated and exasperated he became. That's what it means to be stirred up within spirit, what it means to be provoked. Literally, this verse says in the Greek, now it doesn't translate that way, but literally in the Greek, you know what it says? It says he was in a fever. He was that stirred up. Because of what? Because of those idols. Because of sin. And as Paul's custom was, here he goes to the Greek, to the synagogues, and then he goes to the agora, the marketplace, where people would gather. And as he preached, he kept seeing all these idols staring at him, and his anger. That's what it means when he was in a fever. His anger burned at those sights. And that situation brought new possibilities, though, for Paul, for witnessing for Christ. And as we've seen the first slide that was up there, Athens was the center of all this. J.W. McGarvey has cogently said, "In Athens itself, where flourished the most profound philosophy, the most glowing eloquence, the most exquisite poetry, and the most refined creative art at which the world has ever seen, there was the most complete and studied abandonment to every vice which passion could prompt imagination invent." In the midst of this, here comes Paul, ambassador for the Creator of heaven and earth. Paul is striding between two worlds now. He's striding between the Jewish and the Greek. And Paul encounters, this is why this next slide will show you, Paul encounters three groups in Athens. Three groups that we encounter even today, but we wouldn't call them that, these. But they both share some basic beliefs. Notice what it says in and in the marketplace, the agora, every day with those who happened to be present. And also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Some were saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. So they share some basic beliefs here. Here's the shared beliefs. These three groups that we're going to look at, that Paul encountered. And they believed in universalism, that all people will seek after and find God. Now, notice what I had Tina do is put God with the small g, because we're not talking about the Judeo-Christian God. We're not talking about the biblical God. We're talking about a God. And they believed in universalism, that all people will seek after and find God. Their view, what they thought a God was. They also all believed in naturalism, that nature and matter is everything. Even themselves, they're part of nature and matter. Nature and matter is everything, and there's no other controlling force in the universe than nature and matter. And they also believed in humanistic evolution, that as people advance and develop, their contributions increase the sum of whatever God is. In other words, you're part of God. Of God you believe. And then they believed in the immanence of God, small g now, that the whole process of the universe, in another way, is to define God. That's how you define God. So that's their shared beliefs when he encounters those three groups in Athens. That we still, you look at those, we still, brothers and sisters, we still encounter that today. People believe those things. Those shared beliefs are still with us in some form or another. Most people believe that nature and matter is everything, that that's all there is, and that they're all part of that. And we're evolving to better. So then you have, next slide please, the three groups. You have the Epicureans. Epicurus lived from 342 to 270 BC. This is what Epicurus taught. This is what the Epicureans believed. They believe that pleasure and self-indulgence is the chief end of mankind. They believe that that's mankind's highest good, is to seek pleasure and to be self-indulgent. But however, they did not idealize sensual pleasures. At least Epicurus didn't. Now, some of his followers took that to an extreme, where they indeed indulged in the lust of the flesh. And they believed that was man's highest good. They also believed that matter is eternal. It's always existed. And therefore, they denied that the world was created by some deity. Although there were all these gods around, but they denied that the world was created by some deity. They also denied the immortality of the soul. They denied any idea You're talking about future retribution? There's no such thing as future retribution. And after death? No. You're not going to suffer for the deeds done in this life. Because after all, pleasure is the highest good. And then they deny the idea that the gods, because they believed in the plurality of gods, that the gods exercised any providential control over human affairs. Oh, they were there, but they didn't exercise any sort of control of human affairs. You don't see that of the Epicureans? Now, you said if you were to call a person an Epicurean today, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. But there are those people even today, brothers and sisters. There are still many who think that exact same way today. That's why ideas have consequences. The exact same way. Well, Paul met some of those. There were some of those Epicureans there. We can, like I said, we can still meet him today. And then the second slide, we see, he talks about the Stoics. The Stoics came from they were taught by a man called Zeno of Cyprus, or Cyprus. He lived from 168 to 264 BC. Now, the reason why they were called Stoics is because Zeno, what he would do in Athens is he would go to what is known as a stoa, and that would be like a porch. And that's where he would teach his students. And so they began to be called Stoics. So what he taught was that the world was created by Zeus. Zeus is the chief god. The Romans call him Jupiter. The Greeks call him Zeus. They believed that all things were created by the fates. Now, the fates are not Zeus. But the world was created by Zeus. But all things are governed by the fates. To whom Zeus, and get this, Zeus himself, even though he's the chief god, he's subject to the fates. They believed that self-denial was thought to contribute to the highest end of life. High end of life. And so you deny yourself. Not like the Epicureans, you indulge yourself. That's the highest good. They taught, no, that self-denial. That's why they thought the body was the prison of the soul. Contribute to the highest end of life. Their passions and affections were to be suppressed. Your passions and your affections are to be suppressed and restrained. They held contempt for the common person. They were better, the Stoics believed, they were better than the average person. They refused to acknowledge that there was any such thing as suffering. You say you're suffering? No, you're not. There's no such thing as suffering. Get over it. Deny self. That's your problem. You're denying yourself. They were indifferent to either pain or pleasure. And they also denied the immortality of the soul. It was simply the reabsorbing of all existence. Again, there are still those today, brothers and sisters, who think that way. That's what Paul was dealing with. That's what it says here. But Paul's no jester. He's an intellectual giant himself. I like what Brother Don DeWelt said about these two groups, the Stoics and Epicureans. One philosophy produced degenerates. The other philosophy produced suicides. One produced degenerates and the other produced suicide. So along comes Paul, and what they said about Paul, these Epicureans and Stoics and these others, they're saying, What would this idle babbler wish to say? What has he got to say to us? Why, he seemed to be proclaiming some strange deities here. Because he was preaching of Jesus and the resurrection. Literally, you know what the idle babbler means? Literally in the Greek, what it means is that they were calling Paul a seed picker. A seed picker. A seed picker, Brother Reese brings this out. Good. Well, it was applied to the Greeks, to the poor people, who after a harvest would collect the seeds that were left in the fields. And then the men who hung around, then also referred to the men who hung around the shops and the market, who would pick up scraps, that's what it began to be referred to, who would pick up scraps of information. Then it also began to refer to those who would hang around the shops and the markets and pick up scraps of food which fell off of the carts. And they would live off them. It was also a name given to a little bird who hopped here and there picking up the scattered kernels of grain. And then the word then came to be applied to men who picked up scraps of information here and there, and then tried to palm them off as their own. Now, there's a broken sentence in the Greek here. When you see this, he seemed to be a proclaimer of strange deities. And then you see a little broken there. In the Greek, there's a broken sentence in the Greek. And as Brother Reese says, it might be complete, this be able to be completed more, completed this way. What would this idle babbler, this seed picker, wish to say if he could express his thoughts clearly? The Athenians, you see, they thought that Paul was proclaiming two new deities. That they believe, you see, that these deities were beings who were superior to people, superior to human, but they're actually inferior to the gods. And so when they say strange, what that means is foreign. It means that, is Paul proclaiming some of the new deities from another country? Why, it would be like going down south, you know, and because I've experienced that. Having relatives down there. It'd be like going down south, and you go down there and you start talking, and then the people start talking and say, what these foreigners saying, we can't understand them. But some of them down there, they can talk so that you don't understand them. But they can talk pretty clear when they want to, but if they know a foreigner's around, that somebody from a different stay at a different place, why, they'll put it on thick so you don't know what they're saying. And you know, they want to make sure that you know, they know, and you know, you're not from around here. That's what they're saying about Paul, see? But these people, these men were attracted to anything. There's people like that today. The late biblical scholar Friedrich Farrar, Anglican man back in the Victorian times, he said their greatest orator, that would be Socrates, their greatest orator had hurled at them the reproach that instead of flinging themselves into timely and vigorous action in defense of their endangered liberty, they were forever gadding about, asking for the very latest news. That's what Socrates said about the Athenians, about those Epicureans and Stoics and philosophers and so forth. But here comes Paul. He's preaching about Jesus and the resurrection. Now remember that Paul's speaking to them in Greek, and so he's using language that they could understand. But so what he does is what he's saying and what they're hearing. These people begin to think that Paul's some sort of pseudo-intellectual. Why, it would be as like if one of us or someone who thinks that they're not maybe one of us, but some scholar or something, you know, be like one of them, is they went to the Harvard Yard and started spouting things off. Where did this guy come from? Why, he doesn't attend Harvard. He's not from Harvard. What can he know? It'd be like that. Like Brother DeWalt says, Paul was surely standing as Pausanias stated on the stone of impudence, where men had to defend their facts while the listeners sat around. And next week we'll come to that, because look at what they do. You see, they heard these words, Jesus. They haven't heard about Jesus. Who is this guy? And then he says something about Anastasius. And so when he says Anastasius, which refers to resurrection, what they're hearing is, this is another God? Is he bringing some new deities around? Why, we better look into this. That's why it says, and they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is which you are proclaiming. They want to put Paul on the spot, just like if you had been at Harvard Yard. Because this is what they're saying. For you are bringing some strange things to our ear. So we want to know what these things mean. And then it says, Luke puts parentheses and said, now all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. That's what Socrates said about them. So they didn't stop listening to Paul. They said, we're going to take you to the Areopagus, and you're going to tell us all about this. Explain this. We want to hear it. Can you imagine people doing that today? Would they do that today? But Paul, he didn't flinch. And we're going to see that next week. Because to Paul, that's then we're going to sing, for God so loved the world. Because see, for Paul, that's what it was all about. Here he was standing in the midst of these philosophers, these Epicureans and Stoics, who thought they had that knowledge. And Paul's confronting them with the gospel. And we'll see what that entails next week. But it all has to do with the fact that God loves the world so much that he sent his son. That's why Paul thought it was important to confront them that believed that.